Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and sometimes finance is not pretty. Case in point, this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote.
You know, every once in a while, it belches a little bit.
That's Mr. Bob Moon. He says a certain financial institution behaves rather rudely every now and again. Listen once more.
You know, every once in a while, it belches a little bit.
So, according to Bob, what institution had indigestion this week? Was it A, the Dow Jones Industrial Average? At one point Thursday, it deflated 450 points. Or was it B, the housing market? Sales of new homes sagged below expectations in June. Or did you need Tums for C, Apple's stock price? Seems the iPhone isn't selling quite as well as expected. Don't have the stomach for this question? Relief is just minutes away on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
What's missing from this list? Roller coasters, elevators, temperatures, all things that go up and down a lot. What's missing? The stock market. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Okay, let's get right to it. On Thursday, the stock market took a dive. Fell down the hole, pick your favorite cliche. At one point, the Dow was down 450 points, more than 3%, before investors dragged themselves back to a mere 311-point drop. Similar fates for the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. Now, here's the thumbsucker. This all happened a scant 1 week after the Dow topped 14,000 for the first time in its history. What is going on? For some answers, we've turned to two of our favorite market watchers, Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon. Welcome, Bob.
Hello, Tess.
And our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
Good, thanks. All right, Bob, let's start off with you. I'm just looking for some reasons behind the sell-off this week. It wasn't just Thursday. It was Tuesday. What a 200-point drop or so. What's going on here? Is it the subprime mortgage mess earnings?
Yes.
All of the above, right?
It's all of those things. The market really has, work with me here, a bad case of indigestion.
Uh-oh.
And it's trying to work this through. It's trying to digest the subprime worries that it has, the lack of credit out there now for some of these big takeover deals that have been made.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, you know, every once in a while it takes a tum and it belches a little bit. That's what we saw this past week. We saw the market belching a little bit.
That's very unpleasant, I have to say. What do you think, Chris? Some Maalox in order?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're really saying and what Bob is talking about is a four-letter word, risk. And we go back to February. Ben Bernanke had been up the hill testifying to Congress saying everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, Alan Greenspan goes, risk, and the markets tumbled.
Yeah.
Now, things came back, as you mentioned, but I think that this is part of a long-term process, and just as Bob is saying, a big part of it is a reevaluation of the takeover market and all the enthusiasm, and all of a sudden people are saying, you know what, these aren't such great deals.
Well, Chris, help us get some sense of how investors should be reacting here. First of all, long-term investors who really are only in the market through, say, their mutual funds.
And here's what I would say. Let the hedge funds play in this sandbox. Let them play around and try and figure out what's going on. You're a long-term investor. You don't know what Mr. Market's going to do. Take this as a wake-up call. Are you really diversified? Is your asset allocation the way you'd really like it to be? I use moments like this just to remind myself, you know, I felt really good when I opened my 403B recently.
Yeah, so did I. I was very excited, about 14% on the year. And I think as of this week, I may be down to 8 or 9%.
Exactly. So, are you diversified properly? Now, I'm comfortable with the way I am, so I'm not going to do anything.
All right. And what about shorter-term investors, folks with individual stock holdings?
Well, for shorter-term investors, here's the thing. Let's say you've been watching a couple of stocks and you actually like them. They're good companies. They have good management, good product or service, but the price has been kind of high. Now, my guess is the price has gone down for reasons that have nothing to do with this particular company. But you can buy it at a discount, at least compared to what it was several days ago. So this kind of volatility that we're seeing, for someone who wants to be more of a trader, offers buying opportunities.
All right, Bob, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the difference between a true market panic and a correction. I've heard a lot of people say a correction was due. Why does there have to be one?
Well, the market goes up in value. I've heard some people say that the market was modestly overvalued until these corrections, if you will, that we saw in the past week. The big corrections that we've seen historically are in around the 10 to 15% range. We haven't seen a correction like that in many a year.
2001, probably the last one, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so there is some question as to whether or not we are going to see a correction of that size. Now, there has been so much optimism in the stock market that a lot of analysts say, look, even if we drop down 7 or 8%, people are going to see that as a buying opportunity and get back into the market again. I hate to use the cliche, but it's anybody's guess.
And finally, Chris, a little more historical perspective. We've just gotten a little bit from Bob, but is this really, do you think, just a dip in the greater scheme of things, very much similar to what we saw in February? Or could we be seeing the beginning of a 2001-type downfall?
What I see is that this is a true revaluation of the takeover market, the private equity deals, the financial gunslingers that have been able to borrow and way overpay for properties. I think that's a fundamental change. The golden era of private equity, the sun is setting on it right now. That said, corporate earnings have been good. The U.S. economy is continuing to chug along. Most other economies around the world are doing well. And so from a longer-term perspective, capitalism is expanding around the global economy, and I would not underestimate the economic gains that are going to come from that.
All right. Marketplace's Bob Moon and Chris Farrell. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Earlier this week, I paid a visit to our San Jose Investment Club. It was time to check in again, and we'll have their update in a few weeks. But I wanted to share part of that conversation now, because I asked them for their thoughts on the huge market movements we've seen this year. The Dow hitting 13,000 back in April, then 14,000 this month. What did that signal to them as average investors? Now, bear in mind that our visit was on Wednesday, the day before this big plunge we've been reviewing with Bob and Chris. But I think their answers are instructive. We'll hear first from Martha Alderson, then Marvin Cohn, and finally from Kathy Tegmeyer.
Well, I agree with people who are thinking that a correction is coming. I think the market has gotten a bit more overvalued, and it's doing it on the backs of fewer and fewer companies. It's certainly not as extreme a situation as it was in 99, but it's starting to quack like a duck and looking like it's walking like a duck, so.
I think you used that exact verbiage, though, when it hit 13,000.
Even when I'm expecting there to be a correction, it doesn't necessarily come when I think. My crystal ball is as cloudy as the next person, and I certainly didn't at 13,000 pull all of my money out of the market. But I am looking at 14 and crossing 14 and a slight pullback, but we're still pretty close to 14, as kind of a cautionary flag and a reminder as we as a club and myself as an individual start looking for more and more new stocks to purchase, to be careful and not overpay. A lot of stocks have become expensive right now.
I'm glad when I see the pullback like we had yesterday, a 200-point pullback. I feel that, but when those come, as they do, with the growth of the market, it blunts the potential for a big correction. So I'm happy with small corrections. And frankly, if it doesn't go back to 1,400 for another month or so, I wouldn't be at all unhappy.
14,000.
14,000, rather.
How about you, Ken?
We watch stocks, and as a club, we watch stocks go up and down, and the market as a whole go up and down. When it's down, actually, we get more excited because we can buy good companies at good prices. When it goes up, it becomes much more difficult to find a good company that we want to own at a reasonable price. I don't want to see a big correction, but on those dips, we love them because that's our opportunity to buy.
Amen.
That's Martha Alderson, Marvin Cohn, and Kathy Tegmeyer of our San Jose Investment Club. We'll hear more from them and our Seattle and Virginia clubs next month. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. Before we crack the books in today's lesson, let's get ready with some brain fuel.
Today, I'm going to show you how to cook blackened Cajun snapper.
Bam! Right now.
We gotta cook this.
Ratatouille. Well, in this week's class, we find out there's one financial term that has a lot in common with food. GDP. The latest figures out this week show it grew by 3.4% in the second quarter. What is GDP? At the blackboard this week, economist Diane Swank.
Gross domestic product. It's everything that we consume in the economy, plus everything that businesses invest in the economy, plus everything the government spends on the economy. And then we net out things that we export and then subtract away things we import because it's domestic products. Although it's a concept that's pretty base, it really falls short in understanding a knowledge-based economy because it was designed when mostly we produced products, not thoughts. Almost all other economic indicators somehow influence GDP. You know, all the ingredients of GDP are all the economic indicators that we can possibly collect on the economy, and then the GDP factor is the, you know, stew that comes out when you're all done putting all those ingredients together. Some things have more importance, some things are seasoning, but clearly really important things is how much employment do we have in the U.S.? How productive are we? That's implicit in the GDP figures as well. What GDP really misses is the layers of the economy, the micro versus the macro side, and that's the bifurcation of the U.S. consumer. We've seen this massive, rapid growth. Not only are the rich getting richer, there's more of them. That's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is the middle class, many of them are falling out of the middle class into lower income stratus, or they're falling down in stratus within the middle class. And none of that is understood by just looking at the overall GDP figure on its own. I think one of the greatest mistakes that people do is they look at it and they say, foreigners say, we don't get it. Your numbers look so good. Why don't you feel better? And I say, well, you know, you can add things up, but depending on the components of growth, sort of, again, the spices in the stew, depending on if you do it right or you do it wrong, it's stew and you can eat it, but it may or may not be good.
That's Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. On the syllabus for next week, short sale. A lot of people got mortgages based on the purported value of their home, but values are slipping. So what happens with the mortgage? Chris appraises the situation in the mailbag. And life on the wide open range ain't always easy.
We've had blizzards with a couple feet of snow, and you have to still find a way to get hay to those animals.
A day in the work life of a cattle rancher. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Nebraskans are known for an almost obsessive devotion to college football. You can bet they celebrated this week when University of Nebraska running back Mike Rozier was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. But Nebraska's biggest industry isn't athletics, it's cattle. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a Nebraska rancher. We caught up with her trying to artificially inseminate a not-so-cooperative cow.
My name is Kelly Luce. I'm a rancher with my husband in central Nebraska.
Help!
I guess in central Nebraska, ranching is not necessarily a male-dominated field because it's mostly a husband-wife ranching operation. Typically, there's enough work to do on a ranch to keep everybody busy. I think a common misperception about ranching is that because we have so much land that we're really rich, and you know, they think 1,000 acres, oh, you're really rich. Well, 1,000 acres will feed about 100 cows. We have a few horses out there too. And if you sell a calf off of every cow, which you don't always do, you know, you maybe get $100 or $200 above your expenses of your feed and your pasture and your hay and your mineral and your salt. So it's not real profitable. I would say our ranch at this point makes about $24,000 a year. Winter is definitely the hardest just because you're responsible for keeping those animals alive. We've had blizzards with a couple feet of snow, and you have to still find a way to get hay to those animals. There were some weeks this winter when it was absolutely brutal. It was solid ice, 50-mile-an-hour winds from the north. You couldn't open your eyes because your face just got cut by these little pieces of ice, and you think, why am I doing this? I do like the animals. I like the livestock. To see the products that you create, the genetics you use, the management techniques you use, and to see how that plays out and what kind of a product you can produce, and knowing that you're doing something to feed the people of the world, I think that's just something that I enjoy doing. Some people don't believe in eating animals for meat. I guess I do believe in that, and I feel like animals that are raised to be eaten by people, their death has a purpose. But when an animal dies, like calves we lost because of the severe cold, that's the hardest part about being a rancher, is when things die needlessly, I guess. One of the strangest things that happened to me, I guess, when I was 8 months pregnant with my first daughter, I was checking cows, heifers, calving in the middle of the night, and I had a heifer that had a calf that she could not have by herself. I was a long ways from any kind of facilities. For whatever reason, I did not have my calving chains in my pocket. So I used the only thing that I had, which was the laces out of my boots, and I tied them on the legs of the calf and pulled the calf out of the heifer. That probably ranks up there in one of the more unusual things that I've been through. There really are a lot of unusual things, things you just don't, you think you have a great plan and, you know, you've got Mother Nature, you've got animals with their own plans, and it's kind of hard to get everybody on the same page sometimes.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Martin Wells.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Cellular interference brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, open access. Open access is the idea that part of the public airwaves should be open for anyone to use. Some big wireless phone companies aren't fans of open access because now they license the airwaves and they don't want competition. But the Fed will soon auction some of the airwave spectrum. One potential bidder is Google. Google has promised to bid billions for these frequencies if the Fed guarantees anyone can have open access to them. Will the deal go through, opening up competition and driving down prices? Please hold.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life to read.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's that time of the show where we answer all of your pressing financial questions. at least the ones we can fit into the segment. And along with me is our very own economics editor and MC of money, Chris Farrell. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well, and I like that. Yeah? MC of money. I think there's a future here.
Well, before we get started, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button. Or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's go to the phones. Isaac is with us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
You're most welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a music teacher in Cincinnati.
Do you teach in schools?
I do. I teach in high school. My training was as a composer, and I found a way to be a composer and by being a music teacher.
Oh, terrific. So what's your question for Chris? Is it music related?
Well, not exactly. But, Chris, when I was in college, I knew that the degree I was pursuing was not going to land me a big-paying job, but I borrowed the money for it anyway. And I met my wife there in grad school, and she and I are in pretty much the same boat. So I have basically three questions for you. Number one, can I consolidate my loans with my wife's loans? My second question is, if not, can I consolidate a single loan? I've been getting a lot of mail on loan consolidation that says that I'll get a lower monthly payment. If I only have one loan, can I consolidate that? I haven't pursued any of these consolidation offers I've seen because I don't know if I can trust them. So that's my third question, is how do I find a good loan company to consolidate with?
All right. This is a great question and one that we get from a lot of folks in terms of consolidating student loans. So let's start out, first of all, Chris, with the first question, which is can he consolidate the loans of his wife and himself?
You would keep them separate. You can consolidate. You could each consolidate, but you would keep them separate.
Chris, why not combine his and his wife's loans?
Well, a certain amount of flexibility, and you may have different circumstances. It may be that it makes more sense to, you know, to slow down the payments on her loans and accelerate the payments on his loans, depending on their terms. The advantage of consolidation is you have, you know, you got a loan over here, you got a loan over there, you got a loan from there, and you consolidate into one loan. Just makes your life easier and hopefully lowers your payments. If you have one loan, there's not going to be any real advantage to you to consolidate.
So Isaac, did you take out multiple loans?
In her case, there is more than one loan. In my case, there is only one loan.
Okay, so there would be no need for you to consolidate because you're already consolidated into one loan. But so then, Chris, what about for his wife? How does he go about knowing which companies are reputable and which aren't? Because he's getting a whole lot of mail from banks and other entities saying, hey, you know, come work with us and consolidate with us.
You mean the personal finance industry? I'm shocked. Yes. I'm just shocked. Now, there's a couple things to keep in mind. First is there are federal consolidation loans, like Stafford loans. And then there are also private loans, and you want to keep your federal loans and your private loans separate. In terms of consolidating federal loans, there are three things you need to consider, you know, payment fees, interest rates, loan terms. It used to be that you had to consolidate with your lender. You can now consolidate with whomever you want, which, of course, means you can get better terms, but it does mean that you do need to shop around a little bit more. Typically, consolidation comes out ahead for people who have federal loans, less so with private loans. There just may be an issue of convenience and putting it all under one umbrella. But you keep your federal and your private loans separate. If you go on the web, you go to finaid.org, F-I-N-A-I-D.org. They have a lot of good information on consolidation at that website.
Okay, your answers have been very helpful to my question.
Good.
Well, thanks for calling in with your question, Isaac.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, have no fear, dear listeners. If you are completely in the dark about a financial situation, we are here to come to the rescue. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And let's reach into the email bag, Chris. Patricia is writing in from Moreno Valley, California, and she retired last year and should be receiving a payout from her employer stock option plan this year. The stock in this plan is all employer provided and it's going to be cashed out and paid directly to her. A nice little windfall there.
Yeah.
Perhaps a big windfall. But no one's been able to tell her if this money can be directed into her IRA account with, of course, there are tax advantages of rolling it over in there. Or is it considered a cash distribution and she's going to have to pay taxes on that? So what's the answer here?
Okay, well, a few things. First thing, this is a case where I would definitely consult with an accountant and work with an accountant. You are not going to be able to roll it over into an IRA. You are going to pay taxes. Now, the way these plans are usually structured, a big chunk of it should be capital gains. Some of it may be ordinary income. It could be all capital gains, you know, depending on how it's structured and the length of time that it's been held. And this is one of the reasons why I would consult with an accountant. But you are going to pay taxes.
But at least she's getting a nice chunk of money.
She's getting a very nice chunk of money.
All right. Well, if you've got a difficult financial question, click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. We've got caller number two on the line. Mike is with us from Yukon, Oklahoma. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tess.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I know we've reached you at a place that most people would rather avoid, but you don't seem to mind, the emergency room.
Correct. I work here.
What do you do there?
I'm an RN. Been here for over 19 years.
Wow. You must see a lot of bad stuff coming through there.
The worst things are always when people don't wear their seatbelt. People seem to think that wearing your seatbelt keeps you from going through the windshield. It does that, but the most important thing seatbelt does is it keeps you in the vehicle. The most serious injuries we see are people that are ejected from their vehicles at high speed.
All right. Well, good advice from certainly an authority on what can happen if you don't wear it. Let's talk a little bit about safety of your money. I understand that you have a question about identity theft.
We were notified, my wife and I, a couple of weeks ago that she had one of her credit cards stolen and her Social Security number. And this was a credit card that we thought we had paid off and canceled a year before. And then all of a sudden we get this phone call that some people in Canada have been using this credit card that they got somehow, and they have charged up a total of $27,284 over about a six-week period.
Wow.
What it appeared that they had done was they got the card, and then they made a partial payment so that it would look like there was normal traffic on the account. And then he said what they try to do is once they make a payment, then they come back and try to max the card out.
Wow. I have not heard of this, Chris. Have you?
That's very clever. That is, yeah, that's devious.
That must be a fairly new technique because usually what happens is they just max out the credit card and then they disappear. But here, they're paying a little bit off, so it looks a little more legitimate.
Now, did you put a fraud alert in your file?
Yes, we had a fraud alert put on our file for, I think it's 90 days. The reason I originally called was I have been hearing all of these identity theft protection services you can buy. One guy even gives his name and his Social Security number out over the radio and has $1 million of insurance for you or protection. And I was basically wanting to know what should I look for in getting one of these type of protection services. That's basically what I wanted to find out.
All right. Well, Chris, let me interrupt here and say that I would not buy credit card protection services from anyone who gives out their Social Security number over the radio.
No. Well, he was doing that to prove how good his stuff was. Like, I guess, challenging people to try and steal his identity.
Okay.
I would be pretty wary of most of these services. Where I do think that it is worth pursuing is your bank may offer some sort of a service, but I really, you know, this is also an area where, as in many, in a sense, it's like an insurance product, and there can be a lot of fly-by-night operators out there. So unless you're really sure you're dealing with a reputable institution and you have a relationship with them already, I'd pretty much steer clear of it. And there are things that you can do on your own that can really help out a lot. Because, for example, you know, you have the right to free copies of the information that's on your file. You can put an extended alert for a 12-month period of time after the initial alert has expired. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do that aren't going to cost you any money. And something else we could talk about is whether or not you want to freeze your file.
Is that something you'd be interested in, Mike?
I don't know what that means.
Well, essentially what you're doing is you put a credit freeze on your file. And so What it says is that people can try and get access to your file and they can't. The criticism of this is that it also means that if you're at, you know, at a store and they say, would you like to get our credit card and you get 10% off, you know, you can't do a lot of these things. And if you want to buy a car, you want to buy a house, you have to unfreeze your account, which typically takes about 3 days. But my feeling is, for most of us, you know, waiting 3 days to buy an extra 3 days to buy a house, buy a car. I mean, what's the real penalty here? I think the only people that are being penalized are financial services companies, retail merchants, other people. But I think for the individual, if you can, it can make a lot of sense to put a freeze on your file.
Great.
Does that help you out, Mike?
Yes, it does. And I really appreciate you guys taking the time to talk with me.
Happy to help.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, you know, ID theft can really do a number on your credit. So if you're a victim and you don't know what to do, or if you've got any old credit-based question, let us know about it. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, you ready for one more email?
Yes, I am.
All right. Kathleen writes in from Greenland, New Hampshire, and she and her husband remortgaged their house several years ago. They got a great rate, 6.5%. But over the last year, the rate climbed to 11%. This sounds like an adjustable rate mortgage to me. So they met with a financial advisor and contacted their local bank to refinance, only to find out that the house had been significantly overvalued by their mortgage company's appraiser. Uh-oh. Do they have any legal recourse against the appraiser? And this is something, again, that I think has been happening more and more often because appraisers were really pressured during the big housing boom to inflate the value of homes.
First thing I would recommend, call your state attorney general. Because you know that they have task forces that are dealing with this. So that's the first thing I would do. Second thing is I would consult with, if you have an attorney, consult with your attorney. If you don't have an attorney, consult with an attorney, perhaps that works on a contingency fee. Find out if there is a lawsuit that has been filed against the appraiser, the appraisal company, and do you want to join that? That's the only avenues that I can see. In general, you know, and it looks like they signed, as you mentioned, an adjustable rate mortgage, 11% in this environment. That's a very high rate.
Absolutely.
That's a big jump in a relatively short period of time. But as long as it was disclosed, there's really nothing that they can do about that. So, again, check with your state attorney general's office, see what they're doing, and then consult with a lawyer.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or visit the contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
No such thing as true equality when it comes to banks and their customers.
Banks would rather make $1 million loan to one person than 10 $100,000 loans because financially it's more economically feasible for them.
And what happened to all that restitution money collected in the mutual fund scandal? It could be headed to a mailbox near you. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. The early years of this century were marked by a lot of corporate scandals. You remember Enron and WorldCom and Adelphia. Well, the nation's biggest mutual funds found themselves in hot water, too. They were accused of using special trading tricks to make more money for themselves at the expense of the rest of us. They got caught and had to pay into a multi-billion dollar restitution fund. And that money is starting to make its way back to investors. Bob Frick writes about it in the latest issue of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about this scandal from back in, I think it was 2003. And I remember a lot of talk at the time about this notion of market timing. And in your story, you call it rapid trading. Explain what this is for us.
Basically, insiders at mutual fund companies would trade quickly in and out of funds, and because they were using stale prices to trade plus new prices, they could exploit the difference. So, for example, a mutual fund might have closed at $10 a share in the U.S. and then 10 and a nickel in Japan. And because essentially those two prices were trading at the same time, that one was old, if you had enough money and had insiders complicit, you could take advantage of that tiny spread.
How did that hurt the mutual fund customer, the investor?
It hurt the investor because they didn't realize it at the time, of course, but the actual value of their funds was decreasing in a very tiny amount. It's kind of like the old bank scam where if you could only round up the penny and deposit it in an account, you could make a lot of money. So over $3 billion was essentially ripped off from small mutual fund investors. The worst impact probably, though, was the shaken faith in the industry, because this happened by more than 20 firms and individuals, and a lot of big people and famous firms were complicit in this.
Yeah, I remember big names like Pilgrim Baxter and Prudential and Janus Capital.
Yes, and the list, Bank of America, Bear Stearns, it seems as though just about every big financial institution was allowing this to happen.
What are customers going to get now that this has been resolved? There is some sort of trust fund that is being held with money that is paid in by these mutual fund companies. What can investors actually expect to see in the mail?
A few hundred bucks, which is better than a sharp stick in the eye.
I'll agree with that.
If you hadn't been expecting it, especially, all of a sudden out of the blue, you're going to be getting, let's say, I think $180 is the median payback. If you were nailed for less than $10, you're not going to see anything. So the checks could go from $20 to several hundred dollars, perhaps even more, maybe even $1,000 for some people. The thing that we find interesting is there has been no publicity from the regulators about this, very little publicity from the fund companies and the administrators of the plan. So a lot of people are going to be getting these checks in the mail, and we wonder if it's not going to be like, oh, this must be a hoax, and people are going to rip it up and throw it out, but it's real money.
Wow. Now, why wouldn't the SEC be publicizing this?
You know, that's a question I've been asking myself about the SEC for over 20 years now. They have terrible public relations. If you try and go on their website to divine what's going on here, you'll be met with dozens of arcane lawsuits and settlement agreements. Fortunately, there is a group that put together a simple list, which you can go on their website and check and see if you may be getting money back.
And what is that?
That is investorscoalition.com.
Investorscoalition.com. All right. And we'll have a link to that on our website.
Right. And they just have a simple PDF on their website, which lists all these firms. It lists when the distributions are going to be made, which ones are in process. It's simple, it's crude, and it's unbelievably useful for the millions of people who have been ripped off by this, because the SEC ain't telling people what's going on.
Now, more than $3 billion in fines were levied at these companies, and that's what this trust is worth. So when you look at an average payout of $180 per victim, that doesn't seem like a whole lot. Where's the rest of the money going?
Well, believe it or not, with the millions of people who have been tagged by this, that's going to essentially eat up the lion's share of the money. Hmm. The money that's left over, which for one reason or another can't be paid out, is going to be given back to the individual funds, which will see their share prices rise, you know, just pennies a share. And while we're kind of critical of the SEC for not doing better PR, this whole plan has been actually handled very well, and the money has been held in trust, gaining interest. So actually, people are going to be getting back more money because it's been earning interest for the last few years.
There are some enormous sums that these mutual fund companies had to pay into. Pilgrim Baxter, $250 million. Prudential, $270 million. I think I saw Invesco was $375 million. Is that kind of fine enough to discourage companies from ever doing this again?
Well, I think it was a tremendous black eye. And while monetarily for some of these firms it wasn't much, for some of them it was a lot, but the damages to their reputations was terrific. I actually just did a profile of Janus, and Janus just now has polished his reputation to the point where people are beginning to forget about this. You know, it's a tremendous lack of trust that you would allow people at your company to rip off small investors.
All right. Bob Frick is senior editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Bob's article on our website, marketplace.org. While you're there, tell us what you think of the show. Just click on Contact. We're in the thick of earnings season, and so far it's been a good one for corporate America, especially the banks. Citigroup posted an 18% jump in second quarter earnings, 20% for J.P. Morgan, and a whopping 24% for Wachovia. Of course, many of them were hit by this week's market drops. But most of us do use banks as a place to stash our money, and it's hard to imagine not having access to one. But urban neighborhoods have traditionally been underserved by the banking giants. In some areas of the United States, you can go miles without finding a branch. Francesca Segre reports on a push to change that.
At a strip mall in the Watts section of Los Angeles, there's a supermarket, a grocery store, and a public library. The community here is predominantly African American, and the average yearly household income here is under $18,000. What's missing from this shopping center is a bank. Instead, there are two check-cashing businesses in the strip mall. No surprise, really. The Ford Foundation reports that there are 22,000 payday loan shops in the United States. That's more than the number of McDonald's franchises nationwide. Meanwhile, the number of regulated banks in low-income communities is flat. That's according to John Taylor. He's the CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
When you don't have full-service mainstream bank branches, the ones who replace them, many of them subprime, often too often predatory, high-cost lenders who end up offering only products that are really designed to strip wealth. They're not designed to help the person.
There are plenty of factors keeping traditional banks away from these urban communities. There's the crime risk, and then, Taylor says, there's business.
Banks would rather make $1 million loan to one person than 10 $100,000 loans because financially it's more economically feasible for them. There's instead of 10 transactions and 10 files and 10 meetings with loan offices, there's one.
But the people in the community aren't necessarily sold on the usefulness of banks either. Lincoln Bostick is the assistant manager for Operation Hope, which has a branch in Watts. It's a nonprofit that teaches people about managing their money. He says all too often, young people here spend what they have on expensive shoes, car rims, jewelry, and the like. Anything to alleviate the reality of poverty.
Because of the high incidences of crime and violence in the community, many young people, if you were to talk to them, where they would say, well, I don't even believe I'm going to live to be beyond 18, 20, 21 years of age. And so, therefore, they don't set any dreams. They don't set any goals for themselves.
And that means they don't need a bank account. But Operation Hope is trying to change that mentality. Christopher Wilson came to the program after a bad banking experience as a teenager. He says he got slammed with $150 in fines in less than 3 months. Now, he's 23, holds down a steady job, and responsibly manages his three bank accounts. But getting others to see the benefits of banking isn't easy.
I had a conversation with my mom this morning. Matter of fact, she does not have a bank account because of the fear of hidden fees.
And that's a fear that Robert L. Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, hopes to alleviate in establishing Urban Trust Bank. Its headquarters are in Washington, D.C., and it's designed with the African-American urban client in mind. Dwight Bush is the CEO of Urban Trust Bank.
From a physical presence perspective, banks can be very intimidating. Our branches have more of a retail feel, so you feel more like you're at a Gap or a Container Store or a Best Buy or an environment in which any other retail-oriented environment in which consumers feel welcome.
Urban Trust is less than a year old, and it intends to take advantage of the fact that nearly 21% of American households don't have bank accounts. Of those, about half are African American.
Now is a great time to enter the market because when you look across the the landscape of urban America, we see that the growth in the population between Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans is exceeding the growth rate in the general population. You also have a group of people who have more buying power, more earning power, more of an interest in creating and retaining wealth in their communities.
Urban Trust intends to open more than a dozen branches within the year. But planning the company's future is one thing. Convincing people to plan for their own future is something else entirely. In Los Angeles, I'm Francesca Segre for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, it's summer.
Oh yes, it is.
And that means vacation.
Good news.
And you know, a lot of families are traveling abroad, and you know they're finding out the hard way. It is very expensive to be over there because the dollar is worth practically nothing.
It keeps going down. My niece is in England, and I bet it gets more expensive every day when she goes out and buys a cup of coffee. I mean, the dollar's at a record low against the euro. It's a three-decade low against the Canadian loon, and it just goes on and on.
But, you know, it's one thing to have to pay through the nose for coffee in England. What I want to know is what kind of effect does this really have on Americans otherwise? You know, we keep hearing that a strong dollar is a good thing and a weak dollar is a bad thing.
But guess what?
What?
The dollar has been going lower for 5 years now. But the economy keeps chugging along, and so not much of a collapse.
Not yet.
Here's the straight story. We shouldn't panic about the value of the dollar overseas so long as inflation remains contained here at home. And the Bernanke Fed, boy, they're committed to keeping inflation at bay.
All right. Well, let's break this down into some bite-sized chunks. First, why is the dollar going down?
Well, whenever anyone talks about the dollar, modesty is the key word.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of have a sense of why it's going down. We have some good reasons. So one, diversification. So if you were a Middle Eastern potentate test, you might be saying, you know what? I'm going to diversify a little bit out of the dollar, put more into euros. Then we also, Americans love to buy lots of imports.
Right.
And the feeling is that can't continue on and on and on, and we need to export more and import less. Well, one way that happens in the market is by the value of the dollar going down, which makes it a little more expensive for us to buy something that's been imported here.
So why is there still a fear out there about the dollar's continued slide?
Okay, well, there's a couple things. I mean, you've heard the story. What happens when China decides we don't want the dollar anymore?
Yikes.
We don't like this depreciating currency.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, everyone goes, hey, we're not going to own this thing. Sell, sell, sell. This is the chicken littles of the financial markets. I don't see it happening. And here's one sort of caveat that I would throw out there. It comes from Tyler Cohen. He's an economist I love at George Mason University. And he says, you know, I'm not an international economist, but I ask myself this question. How are the U.S. fundamentals, basically? We've got inflation tame. Economy's chugging along. We have decent employment. You know, that's not a recipe for a financial collapse. The other thing, there's some studies that have come out. And since 1985, when you've had in a industrial country, developed country, a currency collapse, guess what's happened? Interest rates have gone down. And the reason why interest rates have gone down is there's confidence about inflation. So again, I come back to this story. What we should be concerned about is inflation. And the story of the past two decades has been Inflation is tame. We have a competent central bank. I don't see a currency collapse with a competent Fed.
So is there anything that could go wrong as the currency continues to decline, or is really kind of our main concern the people who decide they want to go on a tour in the Swiss Alps?
Well, I'm slightly nervous because, you know, history suggests that when you make statements like I'm just making, the currency is going to collapse the next day. That said, you know, what could go wrong is that there is some sort of sense, some sort of reason investors would flee the dollar. And there's only one reason that I can see, and that is if the Fed does mess up and inflation takes off, that's going to be the thing that investors then say, hey, you know what? We don't want to own this currency.
But for the rest of us, just on a daily basis, the value of the dollar throughout the rest of the world doesn't necessarily have a huge impact on our daily lives.
It doesn't, because even though, you know, the dollar now competes with the euro to be the world currency, what, 70% of the world's assets are still denominated in dollars. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have certain advantages by owning the world's currency. And those advantages are not going to disappear overnight.
All right. The Straight Story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris Farrell, your value is always increasing for us.
Excellent. So in other words, I'm not a dollar.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, want a raise?
It was great walking into my annual review and just having a little bit of information by my side to support what my compensation should have been.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali, with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. This week, special thanks to Phil Richards. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorb. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.